Thank you for listening, and welcome to the Titans of History series. Episode 42, Spain, Part 1. Welcome back, everyone, and I hope you all enjoyed our previous episode on the French invasion of Portugal. My goal for that episode, as well as for this one, was to provide as much historical background as I could to help set the stage for where Napoleon's head was at when he made the decision to invade. Now, sure, much of what Portugal had done recently, i.e. ignoring the continental system, was taken into serious consideration. But there was so much more behind the scenes that helped make that decision not only possible, but inevitable. And we'll be doing the same thing today by doing a deep dive into recent Spanish history, which is going to help us understand why Napoleon decided to play musical chairs with the Spanish Bourbons before, well, we'll get to that in just a little bit. And while the invasion of Portugal was, in my opinion, the official start of the Peninsular War, for many historians, that war would begin today when the French decided that their friendly presence in Spain would turn into an outright occupation. So, before we do a deep dive into the previous few centuries of Spanish history, let's take stock of where we stand in late 1807 and early 1808. Now, while Napoleon's invasion of Portugal under Junot was a long-held goal of his, the prize he most coveted was their larger and much richer Iberian neighbor, Spain. And not necessarily from a conquer and rule perspective, but Napoleon needed Spain to not fall into a larger alliance with Britain. Its proximity to France and large empire were just too important to have them be at arms with a continentally blockaded France. And as we mentioned in our last episode, while Spain was nominally an ally of France at the time, both sides held a deep-seated suspicion of the other, and, well, for good reason. Spain's alliance with France was more so out of being forced into it after their disastrous performance during the War of the First Coalition rather than out of some mutual interest. But Spain did still have a desire to check her declining neighbor in Portugal, and an alliance with France was one way in which they could take advantage of her, given their long-standing relationship with Great Britain. Now keep in mind that Spain was, like France before the Revolution, a Bourbon monarchy, and the memory of seeing one of their own being beheaded by the mob was still fresh in the court's mind. Having said all of that, they had very little leverage in the relationship, and Napoleon, having had over a decade to observe his ally, was well aware of the embarrassing state of the Spanish government, and, by extension, her military. That they essentially allowed the Grande Armée to waltz into their country without so much as a hint of suspicion was a perfect encapsulation of the Spanish military complex that Napoleon began to put in his occupation plans into motion almost immediately, albeit discreetly. Now, Napoleon also held a deep resentment of the Spanish for the fact that, as an ally, they were at best laggard and at worst leeches. Their performance at Trafalgar left a lasting impression on Napoleon, and after Godoy convinced the Spanish throne to leave the French blockade of Britain in 1806, Napoleon began to believe that his ally was becoming more and more sympathetic to the British cause. Now, while the Spanish officially joined the continental system after Prussia and Russia's defeat in the War of the Fourth Coalition, Napoleon's impression of the Spanish was etched in stone, and needless to say, it wasn't a good one. But the bigger question is, how did the Spanish get here? One of the world's largest and most powerful empires to have ever existed only a century before was now nothing more than a mere paper tiger, a shell of her former self. How? Well, that's what we'll be spending the next few minutes on. And so, as we did with our last episode, pull up a chair and let's rewind a few hundred years and dive into how Spain went from being one of the richest global powers in history to the verge of being a mere puppet to a commoner Corsican artillery officer turned ruler of Europe. Now, much like Portugal, Spanish history extends back millennia, and indeed the country shared a common history for much of it up until their divergence during the Reconquista. Iberians, Celts, and Lusitanians inhabited much of the entirety of the Iberian Peninsula, and some of the earliest known cave drawings in European history have been discovered in southern Spain. Also like Portugal, Spain was an early colony for the Greeks and the Carthaginians, and it became a major battleground during the First and Second Punic Wars, after which Spain fell into Roman control. Notably, though, Spain would be the staging ground from which Hannibal launched his invasion of Rome, famously crossing the Alps with his war elephants in 218 BC. Sounds like something a certain someone we've based this series on did nearly 2,000 years later. But, as mentioned in our last episode, the Romans would ultimately defeat Hannibal, and all of Carthaginian Spain would soon be administered by Rome, an administration that would last until the fall of Rome in 476 AD. Spain, though, would be a vitally important province within the Roman Empire, and she contributed greatly to the empire's wealth through her vast natural resources, fertile lands, and strategic location across from Africa. The Emperor Trajan, who oversaw Rome at its greatest territorial extent, was born in modern-day Seville, and he would become the first Spaniard Roman emperor, as well as one of its most revered. And interestingly enough, his successor, Hadrian, would also be born in the same area as Trajan. In any event, as the Western Roman Empire began to fracture, Rome fought the Visigoths for control of much of the Iberian Peninsula. But after the fall of Rome, the Visigoths would emerge victorious, and they slowly began to convert to the burgeoning Catholic faith. And the remains of the Apostle St. James are supposedly buried in Santiago de Compostela, Galicia, which today is the ending point of one of the most famous Catholic pilgrimages in the world via the Camino de Santiago. Now this is important because the strength of the Catholic faith never wavered amongst the local population, which is why when the Muslim conquests of the Iberian Peninsula commenced in the 8th century, the lingering Christian resistance was such that the numerous caliphates were unable to fully conquer the peninsula. And this is where Asturias comes into play. With the north of the Iberian Peninsula always difficult to conquer due to the unforgiving geography, see mountains, Christian tribes were able to assemble and launch raids into Muslim-controlled areas of Spain. And with the help of French, Basque, Catalan, and English knights, the Reconquista began with a slow, 7th-century push of taking back the entirety of Iberia from the Muslim caliphates. Now, the Reconquista is a fascinating period of religious geopolitical tug-of-wars between all the major powers in the Middle Ages, but suffice it to say, for the purpose of this episode, the Spanish were able to fully liberate Iberia in 1492, which is a year famous for another Spanish event, which we'll get to in a moment. Now, the Reconquista did not unite Spain, however, and the idea of a, quote, Spain that we think of today was never fully realized until the 16th century. And indeed, there are still many internal divisions within modern-day Spain, as we see with the increasing push for Catalan independence and the many autonomous regions throughout the country. But I digress. There were numerous kingdoms established throughout the Reconquista, but the one that would emerge the most powerful would be the Kingdom of Castile. Now, after the marriage of Ferdinand II of Aragon, which is modern-day Catalonia, and Isabel I of Castile in 1469, they would merge the two most powerful crowns in the peninsula to form the union which, for all intents and purposes, ruled over a united Spain. Ferdinand and Isabella would begin the process of the Spanish Inquisition, which basically forced all Muslims and Jews to convert to Catholicism or face the consequences, and the Inquisition would last until Napoleon decided to rear his head in Spanish politics nearly 400 years later. Now, the Inquisition also ran parallel to Ferdinand and Isabella's goal to officially end the Reconquista by taking back the last remaining Muslim colony on the peninsula, Granada, which they finally accomplished in 1492. So pious were they in their conquests that they became known to history as the Catholic Monarchs, but you may recognize the names Ferdinand and Isabella from a different story, and that, of course, was the story of Christopher Columbus. And no history of Spain is complete unless we talk about Señor Colombo, who sailed across the Atlantic Ocean and, discovered the Americas, forever changing the course of world history as we know it. Now, after multiple attempts at finding a suitable investor, including going to Portugal, which was the native country of his wife and firstborn son, Christopher Columbus was granted permission to sail under the Spanish crown, albeit reluctantly at first, to find a new route to India. He would be allowed to claim any new lands he discovered, and would also be named Admiral of the Ocean Sea. Setting sail on August 3, 1492, and after restocking in the Canary Islands, Columbus and his three ships, Santa Maria, Pinta, and Niña, arrived in what is now the Bahamas on October 11th, making contact with the Taino peoples, among other tribes. Now, news of his voyage spread quickly across Europe, and his voyage to the Americas, the first of three he would undertake, kicked off centuries of European colonization in the Americas, leading to immense wealth for the colonizers and unimaginable suffering for the colonized. Columbus himself seemed almost resigned to the fact that he had encountered a new colony, even if unaware that he had encountered a whole new continent. When writing of the locals, he stated, quote, "The peoples here are simple in warlike matters. I could conquer the whole of them with 50 men and govern them as I pleased." And as it would turn out, centuries of American empires and imperial expansion would be reduced to vast European colonies in less than a century. Now, as a lasting result, the Spanish language, or more formally, Castellano, spread around the globe to the point where it is the second most spoken language based on native speakers in the world today. The conquistadors, Hernán Cortés and Francisco Pizarro being two of the most infamous, spread Spanish influence, religion, and, most crucially, disease across the New World, and through their enslavement and vast exploitation of the newly conquered peoples and imported slaves, Spain became one of the richest empires in history. The gold and silver mined throughout Central and South America was so vast that it became the hard specie of countries as far away as China. But with all of this newfound wealth, Spain was able to have a huge swath of influence over global and European affairs. The 16th century saw the reign of the great Habsburgs under Holy Roman Emperor Charles V and his son Philip II. Charles's influence was such that he was able to run European geopolitical affairs as if the continent were his very own marionette. The Habsburgs were so powerful that they were able to put popes on the throne in the Vatican, and King Philip II, an ardently Catholic monarch, staunchly opposed the Protestant Reformation, which was gaining steam in Central Europe, as well as in England. When his English wife, Queen Mary I, died childless, and her Protestant sister, Queen Elizabeth I, took the throne, Philip organized the famous Spanish Armada to invade the country and bring it back under Catholic hegemony, only to be famously bedeviled by the British weather. But then again, who hasn't? Anyway, Spain flourished during the reign of Philip II, and his time in power is often referred to as the Spanish Golden Age, in which untold riches came from all corners of the globe directly back to the Spanish mainland. Culturally, she flourished as well, and her artwork and literature, most famously Don Quixote, became staples across the empire. But Spain would also compete with the equally ambitious Dutch and British over the subsequent centuries, and the lack of investment in poor economic management of their silver mining meant that the economic stagnation allowed many of her rivals to equal or pass her on the world stage. This so-called Spanish decadence became a major factor in the lead-up to the 18th century, with the minor Habsburgs playing a role in losing many of their European possessions, including their neighbor Portugal. It would all culminate with the death of King Charles II, and the subsequent War of the Spanish Succession, a war which, while fought 100 years before Napoleon's involvement in Spain, set the stage for, well, Napoleon's involvement in Spain. Now, many of us probably already know who King Charles II is. He is the archetypal model for the European royal inbreeding of the day, with his Habsburg chin and irresistible physical deformities being so prominent, not even the best painters of the day could hide them in their portraits of the unfortunate monarch. Despite being married twice, he died at the young age of 38 without having produced an heir. And all of Europe, having waited his entire life for his death, scrambled to find out who would be his successor. Now, when his requested heir, the French Philip of Anjou, claimed the throne, the rest of Europe went to war for fear that a joint French and Spanish throne would throw off the balance of European power. Great Britain and the Holy Roman Empire could ill afford having a global empire with such wealth shared by these two countries, and even with Spain on the decline, her colonies were too valuable to let them get into the hands of the French Empire, which was also substantially wealthy. Long story short, the Great Alliance of Britain, Austria, and the Dutch Republic were victorious, and they did allow Philip of Anjou to become King of Spain on the condition it would never be merged with the French throne. Thus, as the 18th century began, the Habsburg throne now became a Bourbon one. And while the 18th century was better financially than the crisis of the 17th century, Spain's power in Europe had clearly been overtaken by Great Britain, France, and the emergent Prussia. To make matters worse, her royal court was more interested in its decadence than making improvements to its military. So by the time the French Revolution came around and war with France broke out, they were heavily outclassed by the French Republican forces. And while the Enlightenment fervor was sweeping across Europe, King Charles IV, who is the focus of our episode today, was in no such mood to entertain any of that liberal nonsense. Having just seen his Bourbon counterpart, French King Louis XVI, beheaded, Charles and Spain went to war with France, which they lost, and then went into an uneasy alliance with France, which essentially brings us up to where we are in today's episode. Now, this alliance, which we talked about briefly last week, was negotiated by Manuel de Godoy, who, while dominating Spanish politics in the late 18th and early 19th centuries, was also cuckolding King Charles and essentially running the country on his behalf. And now that we're up to the present day, let's do a quick introduction on King Charles IV of Spain to lead us right into the abdication crisis. King Charles IV was born in 1748 in Naples, the second son of King Charles III and Maria Amalia of Saxony. Charles III was, at the time, Charles I of the Kingdom of Naples and Sicily, and Charles IV spent many of his formative years in Italy, being groomed for the throne as his older brother, Philippe, was passed over due to mental disabilities as well as bouts of epilepsy. Now, Philippe would later die young at the age of 30, and Charles would succeed him outright as heir apparent. But Charles himself also likely suffered from some sort of mental disability, which likely came as a result of previous generational inbreeding. Nevertheless, he was generally considered more apt than his older brother, and the regal council agreed he was capable enough to govern. Now, when his father ascended to the Spanish throne, he needed to renounce his title to the Kingdom of Naples, and upon being confirmed as King Charles III, the family moved to Madrid to oversee what was, at the time, the largest land empire in the world. Now, Charles III's reign is often viewed as one of the greatest in Spanish history, and he put forth many agricultural, economic, and cultural reforms that were badly needed in the country. His 31-year reign was one of stability, and it put Spain back on the map to becoming the preeminent world power again. But unfortunately, all of that changed with a series of events following his death in 1788, a death which occurred only 5 months before the start of the French Revolution. Now, Charles III's death was met with heartfelt sadness throughout Spain, though there was optimism that his son would continue the reforms of his father after decades of wasteful spending had nearly crippled the empire. Unfortunately for them, they would soon find out he was everything his father was not. Now, on the surface, Charles IV viewed himself and the position of king as sanctimonious, and he did want to try to continue some of the reforms his father had implemented. But in practice, Charles IV, who I'll be referring to as Charles for the remainder of this episode, was lazy, dull, and had little actual interest in the job of ruling a multinational empire. And that, my friends, is a giant problem when you are thrust into the role of king when the entire continent is about to go up in flames. French Revolution, French Revolutionary Wars, heads getting chopped off, and then Napoleon. All of this, and your king would rather concern himself with hunting and dithering about while his kingdom suffers and his wife is cheating on you with nearly everyone at court. And that brings us to the real power behind the Spanish throne, Queen Maria Luisa of Parma and her lover, Manuel de Godoy. Now, Godoy was a personal favorite of the king, and while it was an open secret that he was cuckolding Charles, the king turned a blind eye, more concerned with his own personal interests rather than having a faithful wife. Now, this further hurt his public image, and much of the prestige and power that came with being an absolute monarch fell precipitously during the reign of Charles IV. And Charles, for his part, seemed completely oblivious to this. He was happy to delegate duties to his subordinates, mainly Godoy, but their own competing interests led to mixed results. Coupling this with the wars against revolutionary France and her disastrous loss at Trafalgar, and Spain began to enter into the zone of no return. Now, as Napoleon's rise to power over Europe grew, Charles' poor leadership was coming to a head. The public had lost faith in him, his ministers openly laughed at him, and his own son, Crown Prince Ferdinand, was waiting impatiently for his death to succeed him. But Ferdinand was no savior either. He was loathed by his own parents, and by Godoy, whom he constantly was trying to vie with for personal rule over Spain. Their own bickering and infighting was such that it permeated throughout the Spanish society, and all four, Charles, Godoy, Maria Luisa, and Ferdinand, were all hated equally amongst the Spanish public. All of this is to say that in early 1808, the question of the Spanish throne was about to come to a head, and Napoleon was ready to pounce on it. Now, Ferdinand, for his part, at least had the foresight to see the writing on the wall. With the invasion of Portugal imminent, the selfish, petulant child saw an opportunity to use Napoleon to his advantage, and he wrote to the French emperor asking to put him on the Spanish throne and marry one of Napoleon's nieces. Now, Napoleon did actually consider this, believing that having a Bourbon loyal to him and to Spain would be beneficial as it would quell any potential local hostility. Plus, having a Bourbon in the family would certainly increase his already ironclad leverage over Europe. But Napoleon's only available option was Lucien's daughter, Charlotte, who was only 12 years old at the time, and marrying her off to the 24-year-old Ferdinand would have been met with derision even in 19th century Europe. So, Napoleon changed his tact and ignored Ferdinand, which was all the better because Ferdinand would have been about as useful as a wet paper bag. And so the takeover of Spain was on, in about as secret of a manner as was possible, for having hundreds of thousands of troops across the French border. But as we mentioned in the last episode, Godoy was actually perfectly content with this. Being the de facto ruler of Spain, and with guarantees of him running his own part of Portugal under the Fontainebleau Treaty, Godoy basically welcomed the entire French army into his country under the command of Marshal Murat in January of 1808. But Godoy had misread not only the invaders, but also the invaded. But more on that in a second. Now, as a pretext for covertly invading Spain, Napoleon assured Godoy and the oblivious Spanish court that the additional troops were actually in the country to reinforce Junot in Portugal. But behind the scenes, Napoleon had actually ordered Murat to quickly capture all the important fortress cities in the country, namely San Sebastián, Pamplona, Figueres, and Barcelona. Napoleon was adamant to keep the ruse going, and once the areas were secured, he wanted to spread the word that he was actually heading south to Gibraltar and then into Africa to disrupt British shipping. In reality, though, he was cutting off all of the critical arteries back to Madrid, and Godoy was along for the ride. By February of 1808, the Spanish were beginning to grow suspicious of Napoleon's intentions, even with his continued reassurances that he wasn't occupying the country. Many of the fortresses that the French marched on were actually confused of what to do, having received no orders from Madrid to either capitulate or to resist. The French came as allies, at least nominally, and even marched with bands to calm any Spanish fears. But by now, even Godoy was beginning to sense that he, along with his country, had been played. Godoy then began to order his troops back from Portugal in the event of hostilities. But by this point, it was just too late. In less than a month, Godoy would soon meet his own political fate in what has become known as the Tumult of Aranjuez. Tired of seeing Godoy's unrepentant influence over the king, as well as the poor economic state that it had left the country in, nobles and commoners alike found out that Godoy and the king were staying at Aranjuez, a city about 30 miles south of Madrid. Now, while the royal family did have a holiday palace there, their presence was likely out of the fear that Napoleon was planning an outright invasion of Madrid, which was understandable. And they wanted a direct route out of the city to an inevitable exile, should that happen. Many of the commoners and nobles, though, well, they believed that Godoy was planning to overthrow the king and send him to the United States, which, even if untrue, was the final straw. On March 17th, in a scene of what would be a harbinger of the violence to come during the entirety of the Peninsular War, soldiers, nobles, and peasants stormed the palace in search of Godoy with the intention of lynching him. Hearing the commotion, Godoy was able to fend off the attackers and hid himself in a carpet for over a day, but hunger and delirium forced him to surrender himself to the authorities. Although assaulted and nearly blinded, Godoy was arrested alive and imprisoned at a small castle on the outskirts of Madrid, completing his fall from power after nearly 20 years leading the country into utter disrepair. Now, to save Godoy, and again to reiterate, the man who was openly sleeping with his wife and queen, King Charles IV decided to abdicate the throne to the son he detested, and Prince Ferdinand became King Ferdinand VII of Spain. Now, this news was met with celebrations throughout Spain, as Ferdinand was deeply seen as the savior the country needed, and that it would be the dawn of a new day, free of the rotten politics which had infested the establishment for the last 20 years. Ferdinand, for his part, was at the very least in on the plot to overthrow his father, and, well, at the worst, likely planned it. And then there was Napoleon Bonaparte, who was watching these events from afar, knowing how big of an opportunity he had in front of him, now with a giant power vacuum slowly expanding in the Spanish court. But despite what you're thinking, Napoleon didn't have anything to do with the tumult of Aranjuez. He didn't plan it or finance it, and while he tepidly supported a Spanish throne under Ferdinand prior to the event, he soon realized that with the overthrow, Ferdinand would be nothing more than a pawn of the larger European politics seeking to weaken Napoleon, which was probably true. Napoleon believed deeply that he could Frenchify Spain the same way he had done Italy, the Netherlands, and much of Germany, and he also believed that many of these reforms would be popular with the Spanish population, which had long suffered under the Bourbon yoke. But the issues he would encounter in his southern neighbor was that he greatly underestimated the Spanish faith in him. Spain would prove to be no pushover like many of the previous territories that Napoleon had conquered. And much of that resentment would be tied to Napoleon's disastrous decision on what to do with the Spanish royal family in May of 1808 at a momentous meeting in Bayonne, France, on the border with the Spanish Basque Country. Now, only 2 days after his abdication, Charles renounced his intentions on March 21st, ostensibly on the grounds that it was forced upon him, which was true. He loathed the idea of capitulating to his son, especially since he had suspected much of the tumult was his doing, and Napoleon then publicly supported Charles' claim to the throne. However, the Spanish public were not so enthusiastic, and Napoleon, fearing a civil war, ordered Marshal Murat to take 50,000 soldiers to Madrid to occupy the city, hoping to prevent any large-scale uprising. Now, the Spanish had already held deep resentment towards Napoleon, but having his Grande Armée march into their capital unopposed? Well, let's just say that the roots of rebellion were now taking full hold on the ground in which they were grown. And soon, well, they would begin to bloom. From here, Napoleon decided to settle the Spanish royal question once and for all. In early April, he scheduled a conference with both Ferdinand and Charles to, quote, work out their differences and come to a final solution on who should rule Spain. The meeting was to take place in Bayonne in early May, but rumors began to swirl in Madrid that the purpose of the meeting wasn't to affirm Ferdinand or Charles' place on the throne, but rather to install a pro-Bonapartist puppet instead. Coupling this with the embarrassing French presence in their capital, the city of Madrid rose up in the famous Dos de Mayo uprising. Now, the Dos de Mayo, or 2nd of May, uprising wasn't some coordinated effort, but rather a culmination of the frustrations felt around Madrid. That morning, crowds began to gather and grow in front of the royal palace, and Murat, with orders to quell any unrest, ordered his imperial guard detachments to set up artillery bunkers and to fire on the crowds should it become apparent that an attack was imminent. Call it trigger-happy soldiers or merely a case of misinterpreting orders, but sometime in the early afternoon, the guard opened fire with grapeshot on the crowd, and when word spread to other parts of Madrid, open fighting was seen in the streets. Totally outgunned and with little coordination, the Spanish were slowly repelled and the French had regained control of the city by midnight. Now, Murat ordered martial law, and he took command of the city's administration. He then ordered brutal reprisals, and some 300 Spanish collaborators were executed as a result, in addition to the 300 that had died in the initial revolt. About 150 Frenchmen were also killed in the fighting, but with tens of thousands of troops surrounding the city, they were able to reestablish control of the capital and ensure nothing like it would happen again in the near future. Nevertheless, the uprising was all the evidence Napoleon needed to act quickly, lest a wider war break out. At that moment, he cast his die, but unfortunately for him, he wound up rolling a 7. The Dos de Mayo uprising is generally considered to be the quote official start of the Peninsular War, and while I mentioned last week how I believed it began with the invasion of Portugal, there is no doubt that by May of 1808, hostilities were fully underway, and they would continue on for nearly 6 years. It would be a bloody, brutal, and catastrophic engagement for both sides, and we will get into its early days a lot more next episode, but I did want to at least get that side note out of the way. Whether you believed, like I do, that the Peninsular War began in Portugal, or whether it began after the 2nd of May uprising, what is without doubt is that now, officially, the Peninsular War has begun. Backing up a few weeks, though, Napoleon arrived in Bayonne on April 15th, and he set up his camp at the Chateau de Marjac, his home for most of the summer as he oversaw the beginning of the campaign in Spain. His purpose initially, though, was to settle the issue on who would be on the Spanish throne, and, well, surprise, it wouldn't be either Charles or Ferdinand. When the two arrived at Bayonne in late April, they were both stunned to see the other, though Ferdinand was confident that Napoleon would support his right to the throne. Napoleon, for his part, kept his intentions relatively close to the vest, as he always did, but once the Dos de Mayo uprising happened, he accelerated the intentions that the Spanish people had hoped to avoid. Writing to Murat the day after the revolt, he asked the marshal which kingdom he preferred to rule, Portugal or Naples. Murat faithfully chose the latter, and that meant that its current king, Napoleon's older brother Joseph, would renounce his throne. He would no longer be the king of Naples because he was soon to be made king of Spain. On May 7, 1808, Napoleon forced King Ferdinand VII to renounce his rights to the Spanish throne in favor of his father. Then, he forced Charles to renounce his title to the throne over to Napoleon, who then announced that Joseph would be made the new king of Spain. Now, Charles did this likely to prevent Ferdinand from ever succeeding him, but he also had little leverage over Napoleon, and he certainly wanted to avoid any additional bloodshed in the capital. Both father and son would be whisked off to France in exile, and Joseph would be feted with a formal coronation later that July, an event we will touch upon in our next episode. With a stroke of a pen, Napoleon had answered the Spanish royal question, but he had also given himself what he would later dub his Spanish ulcer. Apart from his infamous invasion of Russia, the brutal guerrilla campaign in the Peninsular War would prove to be Napoleon's greatest blunder, and a blunder all his own making. Now, in retrospect, Napoleon's decisions in Spain, while mostly self-serving, were rushed. Had he taken more time to truly understand the task he was undertaking, I'm sure he would have approached it differently. Because while Spain on the surface appeared wealthy, and it did have a vast empire, the reality on the ground was far more nuanced. The population of Spain was mostly illiterate, poor, and fervently conservative. And what's more was that Spain was better described as countries within a country. And to group all Spaniards into a single bucket, even today, well, it's impossible. There were so many variables in how a takeover of the diverse country would work that Napoleon was doomed from the start. And for a man who prided himself as being a master tactician, he greatly underestimated the resolve and outright resentment of the Spanish people to his forced rule on the country. He saw himself as a liberator. They, however, saw him as nothing more than a foreign invader. Napoleon believed it was an opportunity he could not pass up, but it turned out to be a disaster from which he would never recover. Next episode, we'll dive more into the Peninsular War and wrap up 1808 as the seeds of a greater war pick up again throughout Europe. The Peninsular War is a complex conflict that requires great attention to detail, so we'll try and cover all of it as best we can. But it will be a fun ride as we get into some real action in the coming weeks, and well, I can't wait to get to it. Now lastly, I want to thank everyone for their patience in waiting for these last few episodes. As I mentioned, my wife and I are expecting a little baby girl, so it has been a hectic last few months here at the Huddy Historian household. And while I do try to lend myself to having a somewhat anonymous podcaster persona, I can say that by the time of our next episode, our baby girl will be born, and this humble podcaster will soon be a humble father. So, again, thank you for all of your patience and understanding, but we are still on track to finish up Napoleon by the end of the year. Thank you again, and I will see you all on the other side.